Won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing for dollars is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're listening to Michael Lynn talk about how the U.S. has reinvented itself economically and politically a number of times as a result of new technologies. He's interviewed by Terrence McNally, a journalist and radio host.
That part of that was that some of the jobs, but not just the jobs, some of the wealth that was apparently around in the 90s and the 2000s was not real. That it was based
on... It was
on,
illusory.
Right. It was based on credit, refinancing, you know, for eventually, you know, betting on your home and
right. So
on. And that when that bubble burst, there was no way that bubble was going to be reinflated, that balloon was ever coming back, and that harsh truth is something that people have not been willing to admit.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you go the chapter in my book on this in Land of Promise is called The Bubble Economy from the 1980s all the way up until 2008. You had in the United States, consumers, their wages were too low to support their lifestyles, so they borrowed massively. This borrowing was enabled in part by governments running perpetual trade surpluses like China, which were also suppressing the wages of their own workers as a deliberate policy. Well, if you have a world in which both the developing countries and the developed countries are depressing the wages of their own workers, first world and third world, and consumption is being driven by borrowing, and the premise is that people are going to make enough money over the next 10, 15, 20 years to pay back these enormous sums, those sums are never going to be paid back. And if you look just at the United States alone, much of this housing wealth was a fiction. I mean, it was a fantasy to begin with. It could never possibly these properties could never be sold at that price.
Right.
You know, a lot of the mortgages, you know, for houses and cars, there was no way the people who took these out were going to make the wage income necessary to pay it back. So what happens when you get an asset bubble, that is a run-up in the price of assets like houses and real estate.
And education.
Education, which people I think correctly are saying was part of the bubble economy. When that collapses, then you get this really nasty, bitter, divisive, zero-sum politics, because everyone knows that 10 or 15 or 20% of the economy has just vaporized or never was there in the first place. So the battle is to force other people to swallow the loss so that you don't. So the creditors want the debtors to swallow the loss. The debtors want the creditors to swallow the loss. Everybody wants the taxpayers to socialize the loss. And that's what's going on. It's going on within countries like the U.S., and it's going on among countries like Germany and its neighbors, China and its trading partners.
Mm. Yeah. And so what you're saying is that we've had these three republics. And the interesting thing that I mentioned briefly in the introduction is that the three republics correspond to three industrial revolutions, and that there's this lag between the industrial revolution and the regulatory and the whole conceptual framework of government catching up with the new technology, and that we are right now we're suffering the crisis, but we are not yet seeing, as you say, even the talk really of the emergence of the next republic.
Yeah, that's right. My thesis is that we've had three waves of industrial change. You can call them industrial revolutions. One based on the steam engine, the second industrial revolution based on automobiles, internal combustion engines and electricity, and the third on information technology. They correspond to the three political revolutions we've had here.
Right. And so what, by the way, what's left out of that in case someone was keeping count was that the original prior to the first one, prior to the steam engine one, was the agrarian craftsman one.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The United States is
was
older
born
than
in
the
that.
Industrial Revolution.
That's right. It was born in that system.
Exactly. And so there's always been a lag in that sense because even the far-sighted nationalists like Alexander Hamilton, their ambitious scheme involved canals.
Right.
You know, so maybe you could go to New York in 3 days instead of a week, right? And an agrarian economy. They did picture machinery, but it would be powered by water mills.
Yeah.
Right. And so then all of that was just erased within a few decades by steam locomotives and
right.
steam
and you open with this anecdote about Paterson, New Jersey.
Yep.
Which was, you know, just a perfect example of that economy.
Well, Hamilton was a visionary. He was – you'd have to look to some of the East Asian statesmen like Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, you know, to have that kind of vision nowadays. You know, the U.S. was a kind of broken down agrarian collection of ex-colonies, and Hamilton and others wanted to turn it into the equivalent of Britain or France with government support. So he proposed creating an artificial industrial city. An industrial complex of what is now Paterson, New Jersey. It's kind of like these special economic zones they have in South China, same principle. It went bankrupt initially, but then, as often happens, the initial failures fertilized the ground for success later. And so all the way until the 20th century, Paterson is home to one industry after another. But as I explained in Land of Promise, whenever we reinvent our republic and whenever we modernize our political and legal institutions, it's usually to deal with a problem that is already 30, 40 years out
right.
of date. It's
That's
the last
that lag.
Revolution.
Yeah.
So at the very moment that we've solved the problems of 30 or 40 years ago that we've been ignoring for a generation, some new technology is bubbling up that is destined to overthrow what we're doing at this very moment in the next 20 or 30 years. I see that as an encouraging sign. It means that we will never run out of things to do and have established this perfect utopia. But it also
means that we're not stuck with where we are. That as much as we may hold on to and persist in what doesn't work, eventually it doesn't work so much that it changes.
Yeah, and the thing about technological progress is this is happening not only in the United States, these waves of industrial change, but in the whole world, including messed up portions of the world like much of Latin America in the last couple of hundred years that is finally getting over some of their own backwardness. But the fact is, even if you have a really terrible political system, over time you get better dentistry, less infant mortality, if nothing else.
When I ask people what countries they think are doing things right nowadays, people often say Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil has had very good constructive leadership in recent years. Their weaknesses, they've been dependent on commodity exports, particularly to China. And so to some degree, as the Chinese export engine winds down because of the lack of American consumer demand that was feeding it and because the Chinese consumers have not been given the wages yet,
That's right.
you know, to compensate for the loss of the American consumer. But I think if you look at the 21st century in general, we pretend that we live in this decentralized global world in which borders don't matter and so on. The fact is large countries with diverse internal populations and resources like the United States, Brazil, even if you look at our major Western rivals, first world rivals, Japan and Germany are the two most populous nation states after the United States. Having a large home market gives it enormous advantages to your companies in terms of the increasing returns of scale industries. Having diverse regions benefits countries like the United States and Brazil because at any given time, one part of the country might be having a recession, and that part of the country might be as big as an entire nation state in Europe or Asia. But because we have what the European Union lacks, that is a transfer union, a banking union, free flow of labor across state borders in the case of the United States. So if the West Coast is down, then the Midwest could be booming. Those Midwestern revenues flow into federal unemployment insurance, which then goes to California. And so it's still a great advantage being part of a continental union, which is why I'm glad my Confederate ancestors were soundly defeated.
Well,
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Hello, I'm Vice President Joe Biden, and I've been asked not to speak in public, so here I am. Now, even though I'm not supposed to speak in public, they didn't say I couldn't sing in public, so whoopity-doo! I've got such a fun song for you. It's sort of a self-defecating song. I think you'll like it. To help me perform it, I've got two very exciting personalities. First, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Nancy's from our Stepford collection. And also our Master of Race Relations, Harry Reid. And they're going to help me break it down for you now. Each Democrat has their place in the party.
I've got charisma.
I know how to blink.
But no one likes a guy who's just a smarty. That's why I try hard not to overthink.
Because Joe could say something way off kilter.
His invitations might get lost some days.
Perhaps they all got caught in my spam filter. But luckily I show up anyways.
You can't hide this Biden guy. Try. You think by now we'd realize
there ain't no way to hide this Biden guy.
Barack Obama said he liked gay marriage.
For many years that was a fact he hid.
So I put that old horse before the carriage. And I told folks that I knew before he did.
You can't hide what people see. Joe will out you on TV. Our election now will be
decided by the people who watch Glee.
I'm talking with Michael Lind, and we're talking about the book Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum. One of the things that hadn't occurred to me that you point out is that the Southerners, the Southern oligarchs, actually kind of like the idea of being basically, if not titularly, a colony of Britain. And it was the Northeast that said, uh-uh.
Well, that was their whole plan. What destabilized the First American Republic was the fact that at the time of the Constitution was adopted, tobacco was still the largest Southern crop. You had enlightened Southern slave owners like Washington, who freed his slaves after his death, were trying to diversify the economy and make it based more on food for domestic consumption. The Industrial Revolution in Britain transformed America's economy even after the United States had seceded from Britain, because for the first time in human history, you had international trade in a staple good for ordinary people that had always been produced locally before. That's clothing and other textiles. Before the textile revolution with steam-powered textile mills in Britain, which could just crank out textiles, wiping out all the textile industries in the rest of the world, the trade had been limited to largely drugs, you know, tobacco and sugar and spices, for, you know, for rich people. So you had the first industrial nation, and it needed this critical industrial raw material, which was cotton. And so and that was just a disaster for the South and for the United States, because what could have evolved as a kind of Midwestern landscape of diversified economy in the South, there's no reason, you know, why the South had to have a single crop economy. It was because of the South's relation to the British Empire, even though the U.S. was formally independent from Britain. And the plan of the Confederates having discouraged industrialization within the South, the only way their scheme could have succeeded was for Britain to intervene and go to war.
Right.
And that was and when Britain decided not to go to war on behalf of the Confederate States, that was the end of it.
Right.
In other words, all the industry and the military power was in the northern industrial states.
So they conceived this partnership as being as essential to Britain as it was to them.
And it wasn't at all implausible because there was a lot of support in Britain. A lot of Britons did want Britain to intervene on behalf of the South. And what's more, if you look at the post-colonial colonies of Spain and Latin America, they actually were nominally sovereign resource colonies of Britain, of industrial Britain. They imported all of their manufactured goods from Britain. Their upper classes, you know, sent their sons to Eton. And so you could see a Confederate States of America evolving along the lines of Argentina, for example.
Now, here's a wacky question that I don't ask very often, but was Lincoln correct in choosing, and not just Lincoln, but was the North correct in choosing, rather than just let the South go, if it wants to be a colony of Britain and live in the past and be a slave-owning agricultural colony, go right ahead. We're moving into the modern era.
Well, my liberal northern friends, I think in retrospect, they would have let the South go and conquered Canada, right? And we'd have universal health care and a much more social democratic system.
And in fact, I mean, I will take it, and I assume this piece you probably won't disagree with, what that the resentments of the Civil War fuel every election.
That's right. That's right. So, no, it's a legitimate question. So let's play this out. Lincoln, but particularly Seward, his Secretary of State, they were worried about the geopolitics of this. That is, if the South had turned to a military rival of the United States in order to secure its independence, what would prevent the South from being allied with enemies of the United States?
Well, I was suggesting even just letting them go. They secede and you go so long, but still
they could. That was still a concern because they controlled the mouth of the Mississippi.
They could absolutely, even if there hadn't been a war, they could still have allied themselves for the future.
And if you look at one of the precipitating factors for U.S. intervention in World War I, it was the Zimmerman telegram, where Germany offered Mexico, California, and Texas back if they went to war with the United States to tie down the U.S. so that it couldn't help
intervene in Europe
and so on. And I have no doubt that the Southern colonels who would have run this kind of broken down banana republic of the Confederacy, would have done so. Whether the enemy was some kind of German authoritarian state or – now, the really interesting thing is what if you'd had something like communism, in the Soviet Union in the 20th century? I've often thought that the Confederate States, not Castro, might have tried to put in Soviet nuclear weapons along the Mason-Dixon line.
You've thought about this more than I have. But the point that I was getting at was the whole point of your book is that we need more of an industrial plan. A lot of the voice against that is the Old South.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
I mean, you wouldn't be writing this book for the reason that there wouldn't be that the North and Canada, perhaps, would have been the most modern of modern countries.
Yeah, but I take a somewhat different angle. For one thing, I'm glad I grew up in the United States, not the broken down Republic of Texas, which would have seceded from the Confederacy and gone its own way. I think the real missed opportunity was not letting the South go, which would have been a tragedy for the most of the black and white Southerners. It was the deal that was cut between the Southern elite and the Northern industrial elite after the Civil War.
Right.
Well, basically, the North got tired of enforcing civil rights. They got tired of fighting the Ku Klux Klan. So they withdrew the troops in 1877, the compromise and all that. And so essentially there was a deal. From now, basically until the 1960s.
That's right.
The local oligarchy was given a free hand. You suppress labor. You do whatever you want. And in return, you don't try to secede anymore. And you will be an internal resource colony of the factories in the Northeast and the Midwest, which was a disaster. And one of the things I pointed out in my book on Lincoln, not in this book, is that Lincoln's allies actually wanted to develop the Scots-Irish regions of Appalachia. They wanted to put in railroads. They wanted to build big cities. They wanted to give people wage-earning jobs because, they understood the politics of it that haunt us to this day. If you detach the relatively poor white Southerners of the Highlands from the coastal oligarchy, then you've crippled the power of the Southern elite forever. But that's not the way history turned out, sadly.
Yeah. I will say, by the way, when I asked that question of Doris Kearns Goodwin, she said that she felt that Lincoln chose the way he did, because the nation was so new, so young, mm-hmm. not from the perspective we look now, but right. at that point, that to have admitted that you couldn't do what we'd attempted to do as an American enterprise, which was build a country based on ideals and blah, 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 that he felt he was upholding that as well as...
Well, that's the theme of the Gettysburg Address, and people don't understand it. He's not saying that if the South secedes, then democracy will be doomed in the remaining states of the Union. That's not what he's arguing. What he's arguing is that all of the enemies of democracy in other countries, in Europe and Latin America, will say, you know, Aristotle said you can't have large-scale democracies, you know, Montesquieu, and now the Americans proved it. Look, they had a national democracy. It fell down. So you can't have democracy bigger than the city-state or a small country.
Exactly.
That was one of his – and I think it was right.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just throw you this question, which is moving more into where do we stand now, where are we going? I recall talking with Robert Reich at one point about the almost golden age of the post-World War II era, and you write about it as well, when there was a balance of forces between government, business, labor, and almost golden because of the problems with race and other issues that had yet to be dealt with. But does that fit your model, and what does that say about this moment we are right now?
Well, I argue that there was a period of Hamiltonian constructive nation building. During the crisis of the Civil War and Reconstruction, also during the Great Depression and World War II, partly because you actually can overcome the paralysis built into our antiquated constitutional system if there are serious threats and the elites, which in peacetime would not take them seriously, think we have to take urgent action, even, you know, any means necessary. And I think that a combination of the threat of the Axis powers of Stalin in the early Cold War, and also the memory of domestic demagogues like Huey P. Long and the massive labor violence. You had a generation of leaders. There was an establishment in this country which said, there are some places we just can't go in terms of polarization and paralysis. And you can be a conservative Republican, liberal Democrat, but at the end of the day, we're all in this together, and there are limits to fratricide within the political class. And I think that several things happened. The United States lost this largely unearned prosperity, which came from the fact that all the other industrial countries of the world formed a circular firing squad between 1939 and 1945. So the Germans and the Japanese rebuilt, caught up by the 70s. And at that point, they were giving us – and some of the competition was legitimate because we were making shoddy goods, you know, compared to what they were doing.
Also, right around that same point, early 70s, is when the U.S. was no longer the number one producer of oil.
Yeah, exactly. So we lost that benefit. So at that point, the relations between business and labor, which as long as, you know, we're you can sharing the rents from exporting slapdash refrigerators, you know, to the ruined countries of Europe and Asia. So you get this divorce between labor and business, which there'd been an uneasy marriage. What happens then with the next wave of globalization, it gives corporations the power not simply to take plants out of the Northeast to the non-union South, to Texas or Mississippi or South Carolina, but to other countries altogether, right? Like China,
yeah.
You know, Foxconn in China. So the conditions for this kind of compact among government, labor, and business are deteriorating. But also, you know, the politics is not an independent variable here. I think with Newt Gingrich, who's a very able individual in many ways, but he introduced this take no prisoners, annihilate the other side approach, which we just didn't have. Partly because from the 1930s up until the 1970s, when the Cold War starts winding down, there's this idea that we can't be seen ripping each other apart.
Well, also with just the reinforcing power of a common enemy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so I think if you look around now, what are the restraints? There's really no fear on the part of the elite. There are no riots in the streets. There's no, you know, mass marches.
I mean, it's so funny.
Occupy Wall Street, you know, fizzled out after a couple of months.
Well, I mean, I think it will be heard from again.
please sit. You will obey me while I lead you and eat the garbage that I feed you until the day that we don't need you. Don't go for help, no one will heed you. Your mind is totally controlled. It has been stuffed into my mold, and you will do as you are told until the rights to you are sold.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.